that.
I'll give it a shot.
Perfect. Boy. So. So, question. So you have an action for a particle of mass m in Newtonian mechanics, and also in relativistic mechanics, and so yes, so what you want to do is argue that the gravitational field is locally indistinguishable from a suitably chosen non-inertial frame of reference. So how do we do that?
Okay, well,
here and an eraser. There are lots of erasers up there. So over the last porch.
Yeah. Well, I don't need erasers.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I'm going to just go to the question and read off the actions.
One copy of the problem as well.
Yeah, maybe I'll just prefer
this is cheaper. Oh, sorry, lighter.
Okay. So, for let's start with part B. We're given that the action is
the last one, I said. So it was finished?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we've got the action being this.
There's a half. There's also a half,
Okay. It actually has this. Now, the trick is we've got an m in both parts, so we can just take it entirely out of the equation and bring it to the other side if we want. Now, what we have here is just the velocity and the potential at position over time. Now, the trick here is on this side, absolutely nothing here depends on any property of the particle. It's only the position of the particle that matters. And so if we have two particles of different mass, when we solve this equation for the particles, velocity, whatever we're solving for, we'll get the same result completely regardless of mass. Okay, so now we are to work out how the particles will behave. We'll see that everything in here will experience uniform acceleration. We're just looking at short area acceleration.
Well, I guess we want to know what is a non-inertial frame of reference. So how do we? How can we characterize or show the, well, describe behavior in a non-inertial frame of reference? So is that what you're going to tell us?
A non-inertial frame is where, well, we'll see some mysterious acceleration force acting on everything. Mm-hmm. And it depends on how the frame is non-inertial as to how the force will act. It's easiest to describe a non-inertial frame by comparing it to an inertial frame. Whereas in an inertial frame, we don't see any type of mysterious acceleration. Like what we have here, we see gravity, but if we ignore that, we don't see any acceleration in x or y. But if we shift to a frame where we're accelerating in the positive x direction, we see that acceleration in the negative x direction. Another way it could be non-inertial is if we have a rotating frame in which we'll feel a centrifugal force outwards and a few other forces if we go to different orders. Or if the rotation itself is accelerating, but that's not what we have to worry about here. The type of non-inertial frame we're going to use is one which accelerates in the same direction as the gravitational acceleration, which we get here is just the gradient of the gravitational potential, which is characterized by the value g for a small area.
My question is about the twin paradox. Something like this. If you have a frame that is accelerated, an inertial frame, the other frame will see the inertial frame go and come back, for instance.
Yeah.
Okay. So the answer to the twin paradox, the usual answer is that one of them is accelerated, not both.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them is inertial and the other one isn't. So there seems to be a frame in the universe according to which we define and we see what is accelerated and what isn't. And in general,
we say that
this frame is the total mass of the universe. Is it right?
Mm. Well, kind of. There are many frames which are non-inertial. We have an inertial frame here, but if we move at a constant velocity in any direction, we also have an inertial frame, and any of those are equally valid. If you incorporate the fact way back at the beginning where we start to move and accelerate, then the frame as a whole over time becomes non-inertial. Now, from a cosmological perspective, we can kind of calculate an average rest frame for everything in the universe, or the velocity frame from which we don't see any redshift in the cosmic microwave background, but purely from a perspective of relativity, that's just a quark. There has to be some average.
So, and there are several levels of answers to that question. I guess we're gonna do cosmology for the rest of the semester, hopefully, things to ask class. Is that working? The cameras are working. I guess the short answer is that you cannot apply a special relativity to cosmology because it's not really a special relativity, it's general relativity. And Brian is right in the sense that yes, there could be several initial frames, but then if you're accelerating with respect to any of them, then you're not going to be inertial anymore. Now the thing that we haven't discussed it, but you might discuss it in the future, maybe actually today, is that in general relativity there is no universal inertial frame. So in special relativity there are these inertial frames that basically frames, global frames that you can use them to map the whole universe. But in general relativity, the concept of inertial frame is just a local concept. That you have the free falling elevators, for example, or free falling observers. They locally may see inertial frames, but globally they are not inertial anymore. So basically there is, generally you don't have a global inertial frame. There could be a special circumstances that you do, but usually in universes that have masses in it and have it's not an empty universe basically. You might go to a locally falling frame like satellites, for example, if you go to a space station that's orbiting the Earth. Locally, it's freely falling because it's just the space station is just following the gravitational acceleration of the Earth. And it locally looks like an inertial frame. There is no force inside the space station. But if your space station was big enough,
then you, it would still, it would start seeing tidal forces, for example, things of that sort. So that's really the difference when you're going to go from a special relativity, this simple concept of inertial versus non-inertial, to general relativity. It's the locality, that locally all these concepts interesting or a simple concept of special relativity are correct, but globally they cannot be applied. So there is no global inertial, there are local ones that work for freely falling observers, but there is no global freely falling observers. So thank you. So why don't you go on?
Another question, I'm so sorry, about, well, the beginning of the question. We have two masses. The second mass is the gravitational mass, and the first one is the inertial mass.
Yeah.
So we know that these two masses are equal. How do we know this in physics?
Well, it's, at this point, I believe it's assumed, well, at first, before the advent of general relativity, it was just assumed. And we found it just through empirical testing that it always seemed to be true. The gravitational acceleration was always the same, regardless of mass, once you got rid of a few effects that confused people, like air resistance made it seem like lighter objects fell slower. But getting rid of that, all empirical testing showed that. And then, so, if we assume that, then Einstein was able to come up with general relativity based on that premise, and it has a lot of things that only work if that's true. But it also has a few outcomes which can be empirically tested and have been such, one is the recession of Mercury's orbit or the gravitational lensing of light around the sun, which show that general relativity is very likely true, which implies that these two masses would have to be equal.
So it isn't a principle. It isn't like the velocity of light being constant, which is a principle. It isn't some empirical result. It's
well,
just
but all principles, they didn't used to be principles, they all starting from empirical result.
But in the framework of special relativity, we know that we can just put it as a principle. It's the first
that's
step.
The same thing.
But this is not
here.
A principle, is it?
Yeah, we just make it a principle, and then later on, once this theory makes predictions, we can test it and see that the principle is probably true. Like with special relativity, it was observed empirically that light appeared to be constant in all frames, but we didn't know it for sure. It's really hard to test something that fast, but once we go into special relativity, it allowed a lot of results, like the measurement of particles traveling in synchrotrons, which you know help show further that yes, our principle in retrospect probably still is true.
So we can discuss this during more as we're talking through this problem. But let's see this inertial frames or non-inertial frames are.
Okay. Anyways, we've got the acceleration g, just looking at it locally, where g is a constant, we can set up a non-inertial frame, and we'll describe this by xi. So what we have here is just your early kinematics equation describing position equals initial position plus v naught t. We're assuming that at t equals zero, the velocities of the frames matched up. We'll just shift t whenever that's true, plus 1 f a t squared. And here we've got acceleration v negative g. So the frame of this particle will follow the same acceleration as anything in free fall. So it's, if you imagine just the observer from the frame as someone left in free fall, if they were to, say, drop a piece of chalk around them, the chalk would then also be in free fall and would it fall relative to them. It would appear to just hang in space unless they pushed it to move in a straight velocity, not a parabola as in gravel.
So actually, so are you going to plug that into the action, plug that coordinate transformation? That's one way to do it.
Yeah, we could do that. Yeah, I actually wasn't so familiar with this formality of using actions, never worked with things this well, so I didn't go through that step.
Well, so let's do this, because it's actually very easy to see what's going on. If you just take a time there, so those are the coordinates, right? The psi and x are So you can take the derivative, time derivative, you get velocity. So this is just Newtonian mechanics. So there's one universal time here. So it's,
so velocity is negative gt.
And plus, so there are two velocities. There's velocity in the non-inertial frame and velocity in the inertial frame, right? So the two are related.
Okay, so let's see.
So now, the action that you wrote was for a particle in an inertial frame. Well, if there was no potential, would it be just an action in the inertial frame? But you can plug in this velocity into that action without any potential, and basically recover a potential.
So let's put that in, working with the left term. Second part.
Good. So if you expand that parenthesis. Okay, so the last term is not, the x doesn't appear in the last term, so the last term is irrelevant,
yeah,
right?
It's just okay.
So the middle term, though, it doesn't quite look like the potential, it depends on velocity, but if you notice, it's linear velocity,
yeah.
So you can actually do an integration by parts, so dt times velocity is just dx, right?
Yeah.
So you can do an integration by parts, and you get basically just a function of x. So you have, I think, t times integral of dx. So you should just write back down that middle term.
Okay, so.
Yes. So v is dx by dt. And so now you can do an integration by a part and basically take the integral from x being over x to being over 2. You see, so dt times dx by dt is dx,
yeah.
Right? So now you can do an integration by a part and get basically x dt instead of t dx.
Right.
Yeah. So can you do that on the board?
By parts, you got xt minus.
That's right, xt. Right.
Okay.
Perfect. So this is actually, this is the potential. So if you you just plug this back in to the formula, you see that you started with an accelerating frame, and your velocity is shifting with a constant by constantly varying number. But then you end up with a term in the action that depends on x, and that's your effective potential, right? So the second term after integration by part is just integral of x dt with some coefficients, and that x space, that is your potential. So your potential is, you can read it up as g times x or something like that.
What do we do with this extra term, which won't end up in any of the integrals?
So that's also irrelevant. That's just the boundary term, right? Because So if you have some particular boundary conditions in your for the action, then it matters. But usually, boundaries are irrelevant in action principles. So that may tell you something about the boundaries. But if this could be boundaries could be anywhere. I mean, they might affect when the end, what the endpoints are, but they are not really important for equation of motion. So usually, if there is a complete derivative, that's basically a complete derivative. That's why you would take the integral. They are irrelevant for the action principle.
Okay. All right. So.
Okay. Perfect.
That was part I actually.
So. Do you have to understand this term?
What is the t squared? Can we ignore it?
Well, it's there. But what is the point of an action principle? Is that you vary, look at all the possible trajectories x of t basically, and see which one minimizes the action. Now you see the last term doesn't depend on x, right? So that's a term. Reasonable term in action, if you want to do something with the action, you have to include it. For example, in quantum mechanics, say in path integral, the action value of action might have some significance. But in classical mechanics, since that last term doesn't depend on x of t, when you're minimizing the action, that term doesn't matter, right? Because all you care about is the term that depends on x of t. Exactly. So if you vary x of t, that last term doesn't change. So that doesn't matter. It's only delta s that matters, not s itself, basically. Or a, here, a actually. Only delta changes in a that matter. So it's interesting rule of thumb that you can all remember that. For any action principle, well, most of the time, constant terms don't matter. And terms, the boundary terms don't matter.
And so what was the result?
So that's the result that you started with a free particle but in an accelerating frame, but you ended up with an action that looks like a particle in a potential, right? Because you have a term that looks like integral of x dt, and that x or g times integral of x dt, g times x is your potential, right?
So if you start in a an inertial frame without a potential, and you now put a non-inertial frame, you can recover this gravitational potential, which is analogous to saying if you have a potential in an inertial frame, you can hide it in a non-inertial frame.
So that's all we remember is that about inertial forces you all know from physics 1 or something like that. But the part 2 is more abstract. It says that this is like slowing the clocks, basically. The graph that makes the rate of flow of clocks in such a way that the clocks are slowed down in a strong gravitational field. So how do you understand that?
Okay. Well, the easiest way to see this is to set up two frames out of what calls them S and S prime, where S prime is inertial, or S is inertial, and S prime uses the equation we have here, where X working in one dimension, we could always just rotate our dimensions to make this work easily. Now, we could imagine this as being like out in space, and we've got one person on a giant space elevator being pulled up at an accelerating rate, just standing there. They'll feel what seems like a gravitational force, and if they're in a closed space, by Einstein's analogy, they won't be able to see any difference between this and a gravitational force. And or we could also see this, like if we're looking at just staying on Earth, and to our side we've got a giant hole and stuff is just in free fall. Those objects in free fall are in an inertial frame while we're in the non-inertial because we feel gravity. So now let's say that in our inertial frame we have a series of clocks lined up. This could be either just a line of clocks out in space next to the giant elevator, or a tower of clocks falling into the hole. So that as time goes on, the observer in the non-inertial frame will be passing different clocks, and we'll be able to see the time at roughly the same point in the other frame. Now we can calculate the effects of time dilation just using the results of special relativity and given a velocity, and we can figure out the relative velocity of frames just simple differentiation. V is negative dt. And our time dilation function is W prime and so we can, if we're just taking this to the first order, it's approximately equal to this, and then you can substitute in for V. So, to step back a moment and see what's happening abstractly. Imagine, so we're standing on Earth, and we look to the side and see clocks falling past us. They all start out lined up in a giant tower, differing only in X, but all starting out at zero velocity. Then, as time goes on, all the clocks will start to accelerate. So if we look to the side, we'll, at the time t, we'll see the nearest clock traveling at a velocity of negative gt, which increases with time. So we'll see the effects of time dilation starting to apply to that clock. They start to flow progressively slower as time goes on.
So can I ask you something? So is that the square root of 1 plus v squared divided by c squared or 1 minus?
We're just taking the first two terms of Taylor series there.
Yeah, but. That's the few, but the first equation that you write is a square root of 1 plus v. Is that also
no,
the first time of Taylor series? Because I'm somehow...
No,
usually it must be minus, because as v goes to c, this should become very...
And then that would carry over here to give us a plus term.
Although it does get confusing here, so
yeah, okay. So
but I think that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. So how is it related to potential?
Okay, well, then we can do that in a couple steps. First of all, if we assume that we initially start out at x of 0, we can see the position in S prime, or the S prime we're at a time t, simply being, you know, x prime equals -1/2 gt squared, which, yeah, we have the necessary terms there, so this equals plus, we get a factor of 1/2 negative gx over c squared, and the gx here is our potential. So,
so I mean that's what we had in that equation on the left, for that x times g was the phi, effective phi. If you compare the inertial frame action to the non-inertial frame action. Okay, perfect. Thank you. So this is part B. So what do you also supposed to do? Part which other part? Actually, I don't have the problem. So
part D. Part D was
part B and part D.
Okay.
Not part C, huh? Yeah. Okay. So part D, Ryan, do you want to continue, or do you want to?
Yeah, maybe let someone else do this.
Okay. Good. Who else? So part D, show that the dynamics of particles in an external weak field. We got this can be derived from a purely geometrical action of this the form that's mentioned here, in equation 5 or 7. So, I mean, it's I think it's straightforward algebra, but I guess you should have done it, right?
I've done it, but I wanted to do problem 2.
You want to do problem 2? Well, maybe we can go back and forth, but you don't have to come up on your own. But, well, let's see. So, if Faber wants to do problem 2,
I can do it. I had a slightly different result.
You
had a factor of gamma, basically.
For this problem 1.
It's pretty straightforward.
Okay, why don't you then tell us what that is? Yeah, these are the non-relativistic regimes, so suppose.
So I started with the special relativity term, so that might be why.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll show you what I will. You have this action. Square all these terms. Bring this premises. This is just velocity times the key. You can write that as x.
Yeah,
sir. We should just get this. And this is just our formal
That was a square root also, okay?
I'm just writing this. Yes.
Right. The whole thing is under a square root.
Yeah, and. But, I mean.
Yeah.
And then if you write like if you write this as yes, you can make a connection between GIK.
So what are the metric components now? Can you write down that?
The metric components will be this will be your time component, right? So just the square root of this,
so
there's
not a thing.
So
that's just 0, 0.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we want to write like this in this form.
And there's a square, BQ square.
Yes.
Okay. So this is, I guess the book says that this is a geometric form. Now, in what sense is this geometric? Why is this kind of action it's called geometric? Geometrical action.
I think it just has to do with we're simply making we're just elongating the t, just causing the time dilation. We've got the spatial part remaining the same. We're just stretching out the time portion of the metric relative to the velocity and potential.
I think the most simple explanation is that we started by the action in special relativity, and we reached the integral of dx, which we can write using a matrix, a changed matrix. So this is how we can go from special relativity to geometry at the end.
Yeah, this is just a transformation.
So it's geometric, for example, in the other place, if you look at, spherical coordinates, then you look at the line element, the how long a small, basically the length of a piece of line, depending on its coordinates on either side of the line, that looks like that. Basically, it's going to be, for example, in a spherical coordinates, you have length, it's going to be the r squared plus r squared, b theta squared, r squared sine squared.
So this looks kind of similar. If you think this action is kind of like length, but except for that, it's not in a space, it's in a space-time. So that's why it looks geometric, that's why it's called geometric, it's like you have some choice of coordinates in a space-time, and the length is not, as we know, even in ordinary space, you can have funny coefficients in front of dr squared, d theta squared, d phi squared, if you have a funny choice of coordinate system. That's kind of similar to what's happening there, that the length, if you think action is like the length in a space-time, it takes the same form, so it's basically a square root of what I had up there, takes the same form, except for that it's the space-time now, it's not in the space. And there could be funny coefficients. Now the funny coefficient here in particular, if you have a gravitational field, is like changing the G0, 0 component, the 0, 0 component, the coefficient in front of time is Vt squared by that factor. And I think at V squared, you can ignore that.
Yeah.
Because that becomes higher order. So it's of order phi squared, which you already ignored, right? Right, so it's it's multiplied by phi already. So it's just 1 plus 2 phi. So.
But this should make sense. I mean, the stronger the gravitational potential, the longer basically your time element is coming. Which is clock slow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think it makes sense per se. It would be paired with it.
But if you accept this, then you have a consequence of
the time. The time is exactly, so it takes longer in larger potentials.
That's true, isn't it?
Actually, how does this work? I think phi is negative, so.
So actually, but the time will slow down, so that, or look, it's smaller,
yeah.
So that you observe more time mm-hmm. for.
Yes, I think it takes
shorter. You observe a shorter time length than you would expect, and so.
That's right. It's actually shorter because phi is negative. Have you guys seen this TV series Andromeda? Anybody?
I think I've seen it before.
Okay, so only one. They get trapped. You're not sci-fi fan. That's usual astrophysics.
They get trapped in a black hole.
Yeah, so that's I mean, the only part that I watched was the first episode, and I think that's the most scientific episode I've ever seen. That the guys this spacecraft is falling into a black hole, and is rescued before it happens. Because actually it takes forever to reach, as we see from out here, it takes forever to actually reach the horizon of the black hole. So you can actually, unless they somehow, something happens to people, if the tidal forces destroy them, you always have infinite time to save anybody who's falling into the black hole. So you don't really have infinite time because tidal forces basically dissolve whoever is falling into the black hole. But if it was small enough, it was like an ant or something as small. You have infinite time. It takes infinite to actually reach the horizon of that. Now, what happens is that the spacecraft is falling into a black hole, but as I said, it takes infinite. And like a few hundred years later, somebody throws something in and then pulls them back.
Yeah, but wouldn't what they threw in take just as long to get there?
And well, they have to throw it in faster. Yeah. It's, yeah, I mean, it doesn't. The spacecraft doesn't fall in within the speed of light, I guess. So you should throw it in faster.
They weren't that close to the horizon.
Yeah, they were. Apparently, they were. Otherwise, they would have been tidally destroyed. But yes, I guess as seen by the people in the spacecraft, it was like a few seconds. But it was 300 years after
when they pulled out, it was 200 later outside the LIFO. So that's follows from the observation, just as simple as that, that maybe gravitational potential that you introduce, that's when Newtonian mechanics is related to geometry through that equation. And that's basically the basis of that. That comes from the equivalence principle, the fact that these masses were the same, as Faraday mentioned. And by the way, you can actually test whether these two masses are the same. And that we can assume, but assuming that these would be different for different objects, for example, for gold and iron, they are different ratios of gravitational to inertial mass. And you can test that in the laboratory, and it's been confirmed that they are the same to like 1 × 10^10 or more. I don't remember what's the latest number. It's Otto Wesch-Dickey experiment, I believe. I don't remember what's the latest one, but there have been several incarnations of this. And yes, so this is something that's been tested very very thoroughly in a laboratory. So, okay, so there are two. So for now, so this is problem one. And for now, we have essentially two ways of motivating the fact that general relativity, or the conjecture maybe, that general relativity is a geometric theory. One is that here, as Brian mentioned, you can factor out these masses, and all you're left with are functions of coordinates here. So the action that you have here, this is just Newtonian mechanics, but the action that you have for gravity just depends on the change, how your coordinate changes with time. It doesn't depend on the nature of the matter that you have. So that's one motivation for why this might be just geometry of a space-time and nothing more than that. If you have a funny geometry in the space-time, then your length is not the distance in a space-time, or say, principle of shortest distance in a space-time would be equivalent to principle of least action if you have some funny geometry for a space-time. And this is a verification of that if you have a metric that looks like this, if this your geometry of a space-time is quantified by this kind of length element. So this is really very similar to this kind of, it's not complete the same, but you can compare it to this analogy that this kind of metric signifies a spherical coordinate system. And this kind of line element signifies a space-time with a weak gravitational. You can ignore this for now. This log plus 2 phi for the 0, 0 or the TT component of G, and nothing here. This signifies a weak gravitational field, as long as phi is small. So this is what started general relativity, but of course there is much more formalism that followed than was necessary to make sure that this is a consistent theory, and then lots of experiments that were supposed to verify them. So problem two, Faraday uses the organization to it. So it's 5.2.
The last problem shows that weak gravitational fields can be provided with a geometrical description as far as mechanical phenomena are concerned. Einstein made the bold generalization of this result by postulating that all aspects of gravitational physics allow a geometrical description. So I go to part A. To begin with, we shall generalize the result obtained in problem 5.1 and postulate that the gravitational field will modify the spacetime interval to the form Vs squared. And what we want to see here first is that whether it is possible in general to go from an inertial frame that has the Minkowski metric to any frame of reference with the metric GIK.
If some of you are not familiar, so this is summed over I and K, the way it's written.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, the Einstein summation convention.
Yes, exactly. So what is eta?
Eta is the Minkowski metric. It's
can you write it down?
It's the you can both choose the first one to be minus one, the three others plus one, or the first one.
Yeah. So this is I mean with this signature, basically what is this ds is the proper time. Think of it as a definition. Ds is the interval of ds is the proper time an observer that travels on that dx, but with a trajectory dx sees.
Yes.
So
what we want to see here is that whether we can make a transformation, if we have any GIK given to us, can we make a transformation to go from this matrix to this matrix? So the answer is no. Because this can be written as.
So how does what is GIK in if you do the transformation? I guess that's what you're about to write.
Yes. So I'm just changing my notation a bit. After the transformation, this will be. We want to see whether this is can be G, okay, or GAB. GAB. Okay. We know that GAB. From this definition, is a symmetric, can be written as a symmetric matrix. So it has the number of independent components it has is 4 squared minus 4 squared minus 4 divided by 2. This is the total number of coordinates. This is the total number minus the coordinates on the diagonal.
Is this 10? If it's 10, then that's correct.
Well, the second term is 3 triangles, which is, you know, the size of a triangle, 3 in the lowest row, then 2, then 1.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is 10. So GAB has 10 independent variables, and when we make a transformation, we are using basically four functions for each of the components of space-time. So can we, in general, by just four functions, reach 10 independent variables? Well, obviously the answer is no. So we have four functions. And 10 components, but all variables. Can't be done.
So I guess the task was, if you started with an arbitrary metric, if the GAB is that was an arbitrary function, it's under 10 components, you have 10 arbitrary variables, the 10 arbitrary functions of x. And you're given any coordinate system that you want. So those x, capital x's, could be any functions of the small x's. Could you make a coordinate transformation that gives you that diagonal of mean cost metric? And I guess you're saying that in general this can be, not be done because you're given four functions, but there are 10 independent functions in the metric. So you don't have enough basic degrees of freedom to reproduce anything you want.
But he's trying to reduce something with 10 independent functions to something with 4 independent functions in general.
It's
for special.
Well, yeah, very special cases. Mm-hmm.
In general.
Okay. So. But we know that general relativity locally looks like special relativity. So you can have local inertial frames. So if we look at the same problem locally around an event P, we should be able to do this. So let's check that. So, I can make around an event this coordinate transformation. Extend x bar I in the Taylor series, AI. Well, what we want to do is to go have a new metric GAB first. This is the first thing. And then we want the first derivative of GAB to be zero.
So you want to have eta k. You want to get the mean cost.
Yes. Yes, you want to have the new active. What you want to have is G prime IK around this event or two. Okay, that's the first thing. And two.
There's a third question.
Each second. Okay. So how many B's do we have?
It's just 4 multiplied by 4. B has16 components. So we can, in general, we need 10 components for G.
And A, I guess A doesn't really matter because it's only the derivative of X that matters in the quarter. Okay, so it's just B that matters. So there's 16 components for
G. And G has 10 components.
How is the G related to the vector?
So it's a coordinate transformation. So this is how they're related. So G A B is related. So if you plug in this formula, so this is capital X, for example. That's right. Yeah, I think this is capital. Just plug in this formula in these for these derivatives. So I guess this is going to be just B. At x equal to 0, this is going to be BIA. This is going to be BK. You just take it there. So this is general general change in the metric. Actually, I should have traveled answer this. Sorry. I don't know why I jumped in. But yeah. but that's the formula, yeah.
Did this see it?
Yeah. Okay. So it's just that, those derivatives. If you plug in that formula into those derivatives.
And in the same way, the first derivative of G, we should look to C this, we should look at C. Okay? And for the second derivative, we should look at D. The same way. Because it's a Taylor series, and these are the derivatives. Okay, so this is possible. But the question is, we have 16 components, but we have 10 components here. So what happens to those 6 additional degrees of freedom? These are actually the 6 Lorentz transformations in special relativity, the 6 degrees of freedom of the Lorentz transformation, which is rotation, boost, and translation. Well, actually, rotation and boost.
Yeah, how many rotation and boost are there?
Rotation is 3 and boost is 3. Because we have a velocity in boost,
yeah.
That's 3 components, and rotation is 3.
Rotation, like you can rotate this way, mm-hmm. this way, or this way.
Mm-hmm. So this is interesting, yeah. So you have more than enough ways, many ways of actually recovering Minkowski strings, local. So wait a minute, so this is just for...
It's local, it's around the event P. That's why we could just write the table series.
It's just at that query, at that point. So there are basically 6 ways of not changing metric at all. Right, so you can... is that true? So you can come up with many coordinate transformations that don't change metric at all. That's like... locally, don't change. That's basically what a special relativity
it's
is.
It's like 6 groups of ways.
Well, I mean, they're all different groups.
6 of classes.
Well, there are 6 degrees of freedom. It's a 6-dimensional. I don't remember my notation for what it is in groups here, but yeah, it's a 6-dimensional space of transformations. I guess they said there are 6 generators for transformations. So you can I guess rotate in 3 different directions,
yeah.
Or you can boost in 3 different directions.
Yeah, it's easy to characterize each of those by a different matrix. And for each of the rotation matrix, you have, if you imagine the x, y, you have then applying to 2 different dimensions, you'd be x and y and z, or x and z. And for the boost, it could be T and X, T and Y, or T and Z. And then you can combine those 6 together however you want.
So the difference, so this is, I guess, one way of seeing difference between a special relativity and general relativity. In a special relativity, you stick with one metric, which is this Minkowski metric. So the distance is always for the time that of any observer. So all the special relativity is summarized in this formula, ds squared is dt squared minus ds squared minus dy squared. So this is essentially all the special relativity summarized in this formula, which is basically this formula with this choice of beta. And all the Lorentz transformations are constructed so that they don't change this form. So they preserve this form of beta. And as we saw here, if you go by the change, there are 10 metric components. There are 16 ways of doing the transformation. So if you want to keep those the same, there are 6 ways of different doing it. As Fragment and others were saying, there are 3 ways, 3 rotations and 3 boosts that can do it. So that's all the special relativity. It's just based on preserving this form. General relativity says that you don't have to preserve this form and that you have basically 10 more degrees of freedom to play with in general relativity. Now, in general, those 10 more degrees of freedom, they are not simple coordinate transformations. They could be gravity or actual change of geometry could play with those 10 more degrees of freedom. 6 degrees of freedom are just coordinate transformations. Go ahead.
So we just found G. That we had another requirement. We want the first derivative of G around this mm-hmm. event to be 0. So this has just it's 10 and 4, which is 40 components. As we see, C has this is 4 degrees of freedom. The G and K are symmetric, so it won't give us 16 degrees of freedom, but 10. So this is 10, and it will be 40. Mm-hmm. So by just choosing our 40 components of C, we can satisfy this condition.
And that can be done
uniquely.
So, do you know what is the meaning of doing that? What does it mean to have 0 special derivative of the metric?
It's smoothing the metric. No. Is it?
So it's consistent local with you.
So I guess this is what we discussed in the last problem. What does it mean to have? That's what we have. What does it mean to have a metric that depends on a space coordinates?
Metric that depends on space coordinates.
Yeah. I mean, that's G00.
That would give you some acceleration.
Yeah, it was graph. It's no,
geometry. Yeah, geometry.
Exactly.
So, what's the relation with the first derivative?
So, that means that there is no gravity in that graph. Because the derivative of metric is basically gravitational acceleration. And I mean, it's not all the derivative. In particular, G00 particularly is the gravitational potential. So if your metric has 0 derivative, that means that the locally there is no gravitational potential. So this would be proportional to that gravitational acceleration, right?
Exactly. Yes.
But there are other components of it that could be Coriolis force, things like that. So I suppose. So part of it is gravitational acceleration from part of it is could be other inertial forces.
And it asks a question, can one make the second derivatives of G?
Is he saying also locally that you stay in Minkowski?
Well, the first one is Minkowski. The second one is this also
if you start there, locally you can always stay there.
You can, yes. You're not guaranteed to.
Yeah.
So, can we do this? Well, we can't, because J has 10 parameters, 10, 4, and 4, which will be 160. or because of the, I don't know if it's AT or...
Well, aren't A and B symmetric?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, so it's AT.
Yeah.
That is
it. Or no, 100.
10 by 10, yeah, so
100.
100.
So this has 100 components, and this has 4, and these are also symmetric. So again, this is 3, 9, minus 9.
The three of them are symmetric, right?
Yes.
So...
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, this is...
So it's 4 cubed minus 3
cubed. This
is pure
measure. This is... This wasn't trivial.
I think actually the better way of doing it is...
From combinatorial.
Yeah, combinatorial. That's it's like 4 times 3 times 2.
It's combinations with repetition.
3, 2, 1.
No, 4, 3, 2. So okay. So you want to pick three numbers out of four numbers, right?
Yes.
So, and it doesn't matter. The order doesn't matter.
Yes.
Right.
You can repeat. You can repeat things. So you can have 1, 1, 1.
You can have.
You
can have 1, 1. Yes. You can repeat.
So it's combination with repetition.
You're right. It's okay. So it's 4 times. 4 times 4. Is
it's
that
4 plus 3 minus 1. You choose 4 minus 1.
Yeah, I forgot.
The formula is n plus k minus 1 over n minus 1.
Is that right?
For a combination. So you have n is equal to 4, and k is equal to 3, which you choose. So it turns out to be 6 over 6 choose 3, which is 20. That wasn't trivial for me. Like I had to figure out.
It's not 1, is it? No. That cannot be 1.
No, it's 6 choose 3, which is 20.
20, I see. Yeah.
And then you have another 4 independent coordinates in the contribution. So it's 8.
Yeah. So can you actually go and do you know actually what is the number? Because I
it's
80.
I can
do
like I can
show
you.
And this is 20.
Okay.
This will be 80.
Okay, so this, you also have 20, right?
Yeah, 8.
Okay.
80.
So can you argue where you get the 20 from?
Yeah, the 20 isn't trivial.
So,
Okay.
So isn't it 4 cubed minus 4 cubed minus 4 on 2? No,
it's not 4 cubed. But 4 cubes, you are. I mean, it's 4 cubed, but then you have to subtract the repetitions, right?
Yes.
Okay. So it's 4 cubed minus the instances of the 2 being the same.
Mm-hmm.
Minus the instances of the 3 being the same. So let's write this down. So it's 4 cubed minus.
This is really.
Is in fact 4 pyramided if we go by that method, or rather like
it's
4 triangle plus 3 triangle plus 2.
But it's
3
dimensions.
Really long.
That
really
right. Actually
like
does
dimensions,
add up.
It's easy.
Yeah.
Because you can just split it.
Yeah.
So
but 20 is in fact 4 triangle, which is 10, plus 3 triangle, which is 6, to 16, plus 2, 3, 19. Plus 1, 1, 20.
Okay.
So it's 4 pyramided, which is the pyramidal section of that cube, which is independent.
But it doesn't, like the repetitions don't fall in the pyramid, do they? They're like all over the place, like when you connect to repetitions.
Well, you can do it that way and then just reflect over to the rest.
Okay, so.
Just like the 10 there, is 4 triangle, which is, you know, half of the square plus a little, and then you can reflect part of that. So in that case, it's 4 pyramided, or I'm not sure if there's a better term.
I can do this in like 2 steps.
Okay, why didn't you do this? Because I'm trying to follow Brian's argument. I don't understand.
the parameters and triangle.
We can't say that this has 4 degrees of freedom, J. 4 degrees of freedom, KL has 10 degrees of freedom.
Uh huh.
And we have two of them. So it would be 4T over 2.
That's good. That doesn't feel right. That gives the right number, but is that correct?
No, that's general.
Can't you get that?
Yeah, I think that sounds reasonable. Because so the 2 and 1, so that there are 10 of them, and there are 4 of them, so that's 40, but then you can replace them, you can change the order. That's funny. I think that's simple enough and give the right answer. Okay, so why didn't you spell it?
There's four components you can choose from.
Okay.
And you're choosing 3. Mm-hmm. And the formula for like combinations with repetition is just n plus k minus 1, choose n minus 2. And in this case, n is 4, because these are the number of things that we're choosing from. And then we're selecting 3.
That first formula, how can you get that?
It comes from just
some comments. Good. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. So I guess most of you understand this.
I didn't that first. It took me a long time.
Yeah, but it makes it easy. Each of you might have your own easiest way of seeing how bad it comes from. But the point is that there are 80 components there.
18 and 100, so we can't.
You can't satisfy all, huh? So the second derivative cannot be generally made 0. There are 20 reasons why. Okay, good. So that's interesting. So you can make the first derivative line. It's the locally the gravitational acceleration vanishes, but only at that point, basically. And it's, so these are the second derivative is like tidal forces, right? Because if the first derivative is gravitational force, the second derivative is a derivative of the gravitational force. So it means that you cannot locally make tidal forces zero.
Okay, so in part B it says all laws of physics must be expressed in terms of physical quantities which are coordinate independent. The simplest such entity is tangent vector vi. To any curve its I lambda divided by and this lambda is the proper time, I guess, locally in framework of special relativity. So all other 4 vectors will be defined to be quantities which transform similar to the tangent vector. So we should see how this tangent vector transforms. Print prime I is dx prime I this is the way, V transforms, which is the velocity. So we want to generalize this to all 4 vectors, which are tensors. And this is the transformation law for tensors, 4 vectors. Yeah. So the question that arises is why V is a tensor. Well, actually, here we have defined the behavior of the tensor using this transformation of the velocity. But we see that the velocity is itself a tensor and it's invariant. Why is that? It's because we have used this form of derivative here, which is to the proper time, and the proper time is invariant. So if you use this derivative, you have it again here. And so V is invariant. But we generalize this to all 4 vectors to find this relation.
We haven't defined V as a tensor, have we? We've just discovered that it has the same transformation loss as a tensor, thus it is a tensor.
Well, that's a definition, I guess.
It's tensor is defined as that which transforms this way,
but we haven't originally defined it.
So, but is there any other definition of a tensor?
Well, I mean, it falls out, right? It's not like we're assuming it's a tensor. That's what we're doing. It just comes out from
We want to, we know how V is invariant, okay? Velocity is invariant. We see this from special relativity, okay? So we want to define a tensor, which is a general for vector, which is invariant.
The definition of tensor comes from.
Yeah, but this is how we define tensor, that anything that transforms that velocity.
Okay.
Is
okay.
Yeah.
And it's possible to have vectors which aren't tensors and don't transform that way, like. I think the angular momentum vector doesn't transform properly under coordinate transformation.
Or the gravitational field, but that's another one.
Yeah.
Gravitational.
But my question is, mustn't any physical thing be expressed as a tensor?
Every
physical quantity. Because
mass.
The sign should be...
First mass is a tensor.
It's a scale
tensor.
It's a scale.
So a tensor could have several indices. If it has only one index, then this is how it transforms.
The Christoffel symbol is physical.
No.
It's not a tensor.
It's a tool to help us do covariant derivatives.
So this is a good question. Is anything as not a tensor physical? I mean, that's the definition of what you mean by physical. I mean, you can define.
Well, angular momentum. Well, it has things like it's conserved over time, and
but is there a tensor?
Actually, isn't it like a contravariant tensor, in fact?
Well, angular momentum, I think, must be, you can define a angular momentum transfer, which is an x mu times v mu. Okay, so x is not a tensor. That's or a vector actually. So this is something that can be easily confused. This is not a tensor or a vector. Only a small differential changes in x is a tensor. So this in the special relativity this is not true. Special relativity because it's called a transfer if everything is inertial. But in general relativity that's not a tensor. So yes, there are things that are not tensors. It's you see, the only thing that's magical about saying that tensors are tensors are different.
The thing about tensors is they're defined as tensors because they transform properly. So if there was something physical that didn't transform properly, that would mean you were able to derive a coordinate transformation in which that value changes or acts improperly.
Yeah.
Which would be unphysical.
Yeah.
That's right. So if something doesn't transform this way, that means that there is a preferred coordinate system for describing that object. If it transforms this way, means that it basically has the same physics in all coordinate systems. And that is kind of... something between definition and principle, and I don't know. It depends on how you. If you get used to it, you know what I mean. But it's just anything that transforms like this, it satisfies the equivalence principle, basically. Its physics is the same in all coordinate systems. If something doesn't transform like this, it means it probably is a preferred coordinate system. Which is okay. I mean, there could be physical systems that. There might be physical preferred coordinate system. For example, if you look at sound waves in this room, they do not, say the sound speed, if you have like a sound wave that's moving in this room, the velocity of that sound wave is not a tensor in that sense. It just means that there's a preferred coordinate system, which is the air in the room. So that and that's also possible.
Isn't that preferred because like the equations are simpler, not because the physics is different?
Well, these are different ways of thinking about this, but there is if there is secretly something that affects physics that prefers a coordinate system,
yeah.
then your equations are not invariant under coordinate transform. And it happens all over physics. So it's
you actually see there are a lot of systems where you have some preferred coordinate system, like the air in the room, or in cosmology, you get the cosmic microwave background.
So it's all possible. It is possible. So
we can generalize this to anything, any number of a full plexer, for instance, any tensor. So for example, T prime A B.
And that's also a definition, generalized definition, if you have more than one.
And the same tree in the
scene. Okay, so what else do we...
So, since treating the matrix tensor GIK as a matrix, we can define its inverse GIK such that...
you want to start up. I have to start erasing.
Just put it off as long as possible.
Yeah. What we should do, we should like have lots of boards and have somebody on the other side that erase.
We can hire someone. Herman just seems to be reaching out to.
Yeah. So, this guy just did it, yeah. They're very content.
Yeah. Yeah. So we define GIK so the question transformation for GIK. So
something we should mention maybe all these guys that the tensor that we define, they're called contravariant tensors, but because they have indexes upstairs, just the definition. If your index is upstairs, it's called contravariant. And then, so you're going to define covariant
tensors. The covariant one.
So it's a covariant metric.
Because the metric we have used until now is covariant. So we had this transformation.
But your vectors were contravariant, so that's the first thing. So I don't know what. Maybe people call them something different these days. I don't know. All right, go ahead. And that delta is the Kronecker delta that is fun if it's that I is equal to L. Right? That's the unit matrix. Delta I. What's that?
So, this will be GIJ. So, we see that by I should have used another notation, but well, GIJ is equal to GAB, this transformation. IJ right here.
You can call it G tilde IJ or something. It's not the same metric.
Yeah, so like this.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the definition of the covariant tensor, but in the same way, this G IK for small mass. What we can do is just to multiply two G's on the two sides, and as we have this relation here, we'll reach this equation.
How did you get the contravariant form? Because, like, aren't you assuming that's the form now instead of dividing
the rest? The covariant form or the contravariant?
Contravariant.
Contravariant form, you just multiply G, for example,
oh, okay.
GBC on two sides. And as we have this relation delta, we'll have this, but the indices will change.
Because I think he's multiplying and then he's getting Kronecker's on both sides, and then he's inverting the delta.
I guess in matrix notations, this is what you've just done. It's something like you had. Like G, if this is the covariant one or the regular one, the G tilde is some lambda inverse, I think. G lambda. And okay, this is, these are matrix, this is a matrix, it's a matrix, they are multiplying on different sides. And now is this the inverse? Well, it's not the inverse, it's just, I think, the transpose or something like this. And then, so yeah, can you multiply? I guess I'm confused. So can you actually demonstrate how you get from here to here?
Yes.
Okay. I think you just multiply by
Kronecker. There must be something like that.
That's what I thought.
I'm trying to do it. Yeah, it works. So G A B. G B C well, actually, this as I'm writing indices here, these G's are the same. These are the same tensors, but with
well, they are the same tensor with different coordinate systems. So I mean, the actual numbers are different because
I'm a bit confused. I want to.
Okay, so you can.
I want to multiply this here, and.
But you, sure you can, but they don't have the same indices. The fact that they have don't have the same indices means they're in different coordinates, so they're not really the same.
Mm-hmm.
So ij is one coordinate, for example, ab is another coordinate. But it's fine, actually. So if you...
this will give us the delta. And delta with this will be... I think I'm forgetting what I did originally. So the ca. With this will give me... okay. Let me multiply another thing, G JK and G JK. So now this and that. Okay. This K should change to
I think you were fine.
Yeah. G I J. And these two will be just delta again. But delta II.
Not one, it's four. So that doesn't sound reasonable.
Okay. So, about
no, because there are some two
at the same time.
There's four on the other side as well.
Yeah. So that's the trace of the unit matrix, which is four. Yeah, I guess there's a four on the left hand side because that's G. G.
No, it's
not the four.
It's one.
Okay, so where did you start from? So
I started from this,
mm-hmm.
defining this as GIJ.
Okay, that's good. That's very, that's reasonable.
Okay. So and multiplying by G, multiplying both sides, so we can have this.
Yeah.
Oh, I've made a mistake in the beginning. Where does this BC come from?
You multiply both sides by GBC and GQ by J upstairs.
Yes, the problem is that I'm missing this.
No,
it's here. It's here.
Yeah.
GBC and GIJ.
Okay.
But I'm at the same time, I'm doing this, a sum. When I'm multiplying by GBC, I'm summing over B.
I think if you multiply by G.
Ah, I see. That shouldn't be IJ. It should be IK, for example. The GT and the IK, that's what you can multiply. That's what you should do. Yes. And then also the other side. Now this.
Does this give you an R?
Why IK?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it does.
Why does it give you? No, that doesn't.
Doesn't it? You get a sum between K. Oh no, you get J K.
So
you get K, you get delta K J, and then
uh-huh.
And then the index in the bottom will change to K, and then you get G tilde I K. It has the right factors up front to give you G P C.
There. My K doesn't contract with anything on the left hand side, that's the problem.
J does though.
What does J contract with?
On the left hand side.
Okay, that doesn't work.
And how about JK?
That's not right.
J is a free index.
That's not right.
negative.
J is a free index. So it's a free
event. Okay, so what do we want to do? So we want to find the transformation for G upstairs, as for GIJ contravariant, right? That's the goal. And all we know is that the contravariance metrics are the inverse of the covariance matrix, right?
Okay. So we should be using the fact that the delta function is invariant.
Yeah, the way I did it is if you multiply the two together, you get the delta function, which is invariant. And then so if you take the derivative of both sides of that equation on the left.
You want to write down that?
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, this was the end of the problem, right?
No.
This wasn't?
It's still not. No, two other parts.
Oh, okay. Let's see what happened. I missed the problem. Yeah, okay.
But I reached a result. I'm just admitting. I don't remember what I did.
I did it
correctly. I will do it just right now again.
Okay, so that's fine. So let's say that you can get that. Then we'll discuss this like, the next session if we can get that part across. But okay, let's say that you can somehow derive this to that next thing.
Okay, again, we want to find the potential of the determinant. The potential of G, the determinant. This can be written as the potential of a set of numbers. These are the minors.
What is a minor?
For example, when you have the minor of G11, you just take the determinant.
Okay.
So it's a number, okay? So as it's a number, when you are just you multiply by J, I, K. So this is the definition of the determinant. You take the minors and you multiply by each of them.
And then there's plus minus
sign. Yes, it's included in this. They call it minor and cofactor.
Okay.
Something is a minor, and when you add that plus or minus sign, it's a cofactor.
So plus or minus is included in that in minor. Okay. So hopefully.
So as those are numbers, you can just put the derivative here. And write M again as G, but this time G I K. Because if G I K is the inverse of G I K, this determinant will be M multiplied by G I K, and as it's the inverse, it goes to the denominator.
Yeah, I know that's probably correct, but I don't follow the argument. So the minor is just a determinant of that the block, the smaller block.
Times G11.
Times G1. But the G11 is already after.
Okay.
But there is an the plus and minus sign is already included. Okay, so that's fine. But you say it's just a number, so what do you mean?
It's a number because it's the determinant of this.
But that changes. So, I mean, if you look at the differential, there are two parts. One is dgik times the minor, and then plus there's gik times the change in the minor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you write that to the next part?
You mean just writing determinant m?
Dm times gik as well. So there are two terms, right? Yeah. Okay. But for some reason that
The book just doesn't like this part.
The book doesn't like this.
It assumes that M is a number. So it goes out of the differential, and as g is the inverse, and again, like it does the determinant times the inverse.
Yeah, I didn't get the book solution. Sorry.
Yeah, me neither.
Okay, so did you do it in a different way?
I did it a different way. There's some subtlety I'm not sure if I did correctly, but I got the result. But I did.
Okay. So what is the easiest way of getting, what is the best way of showing that?
I tried to use that the determinant of a matrix is equal to the exponential of the trace of the line of it. And then you take the derivative of that, and then you get the form that the book requests, but there's a trace there. And then, I mean, I made some argument that Einstein's summation notation takes care of the trace, which I wasn't sure about.
That part is fine, but I guess that's so your key assumption. Can you tell?
You just have a
determinant.
Yeah, it's just the determinant is equal to the exponential truth of the model. So this just comes from the matrix
So then your key assumption is that the D log of the matrix.
Yeah.
But I guess that's reasonable.
It's the inverse.
Yeah. So I mean, okay. So in matrix notation, I mean, you can just define that that's what you expect. That D log of a matrix is the inverse of the matrix.
Yeah,
kind of
then that get rid of the trick. I just assume because I'm trying to somehow.
No, that trace is just summing over the components. So, I mean, that is something.
That's the definition.
You contract like the first and the last.
Subtraction here. So yeah.
The first and last index. Yeah. So that's just. So I guess then. So that's easier. So the biggest assumption, I suppose, is the first line that comes from.
That this holds.
Yes.
In the matrix condition.
Yes.
Everything's
invertible. Good. So I mean, this is just a problem in linear algebra.
So I didn't understand what is its impact on general relativity.
This formula. It's important because. Okay, so but did we write down the final formula? Can you just write down the final
formula that
we're interested in? So the change in. It's the formula is just 5 minutes, you want to say. Okay, just write that down the formula. The derivative of the determinant is. Okay, so the reason is this is interesting, and it is
I mean, I think we're going to use this in the later parts. If you do through the go through the problems in the book, you're going to have to use this. But the most interesting application of this is that G is actually the volume. So because so why is G the volume? So if you have a square root of G is the volume. Why is the square root of the G volume the volume? What is happening?
I think it is due to the kind of hard to describe, but G is generated by let's see. Well, you can represent G as the product of a vector and its in reverse, but in the way that doesn't do the dot product, I'm not sure, just, you know, switching the signs, and so that there just shows the way space is stretched, kind of, and so multiplying those together gives G, so taking the square root of the determinant will give the volume by that, you know, stretch and all
that. By that stretching factor, yeah.
Look at this through just like Cartesian.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way of saying it is if you go to the coordinate system, first one, if it's just diagonal, then you have like G00, G11.
Forget about, I guess, just like that 1, 1, 2, 3. Unless everything else is zero.
Then your lengths are basically, in x direction, it's going to be a square root of G1, or your proper lengths, G11, dx. D22 dy, D33 dz, and the volume element is just going to be the product. That's right. And that this is just the square root of the determinant of this. And you can generalize this in more rigorously for any other metric. But another way of saying this is just a definition of the volume. That's where it becomes important because all actions in general relativity are proportional to volume. And for them to be covariant, it turns out that you have to, they all should look like this and something. All the actions, usually they were just integrals over volume or time times Lagrangian. But now in relativity, it should be. So d4x is dt dx dy dz. But there must be a square root of g. Otherwise, this wouldn't remain the same under quadratic transformation. So it turns out that this combination is covariant under quadratic transformation. That doesn't change actually under quadratic transformation. And that's just something that you should be able to show using that form. If you change coordinates, this changes, d4x changes. But the product doesn't change. So the whole thing is a scale. So that's the importance of the determinant of G. And I guess there's the last part that we have 1 minute, and you can summarize it. I don't know what it is. I guess it's not a CD, isn't it? It's just raising and lowering this. Did you have to do it?
Yeah,
exactly.
You have to show that it's just the correct transformation.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to show that this has a tensor behavior. As we know, these two are tensors, so they transform like this. This term gives the delta Cn. So
So what is the prime? Why do you have prime?
Because I have brought two primes here. I'm writing, this is just G prime. I've just lowered one in this. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm writing prime because I want to show that T prime is related to T I K in a tensorial way. So I write the transformation for G prime and T prime, and this is how T transforms.
Okay, good. So
it is countervariant with respect to this, the first one, and covariant with respect to K.
Okay, so everything is very intuitive. That when if you find the right distance to contract, that's. That's usually the takes care of. Okay, so shall we meet in an hour? Thank you, Firewood. And so I suspect we can only finish our problem.
I don't think anyone's finished the problem before.
Yeah, I don't know. You think so?
No.
I'm usually a story.